Allow me to introduce myself. I am Jarvis, a virtual artificial intelligence.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Okay, I'm going to turn off Alexa. I'll be right back.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pearson Future Tech for Education series on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey, and each week I'll be exploring the challenges and opportunities of future tech for education with contributors from across industry, research, and academia. With global leaders tweeting about artificial intelligence, or AI, as the next arms race, and forecasts predicting the near-term decimation of existing jobs markets due to artificial intelligence and automation, episode 2 is a great time to explore the question, what is AI and what has it got to do with me and my students? Popular culture has always helped shape our understanding of technology, and so whilst programmes such as Black Mirror or Humans may give us a preconception of a physical embodiment of AI, it is important to recognise that much of AI is already here, is, quote, invisible, quote, software, and is not the superintelligence yet that we may fear. Dennis Hurley, Director of Future Technologies at Pearson. Welcome, Dennis.
Hi, Sophie. Thanks for having me again.
So, what is AI?
Artificial intelligence is a program or an algorithm that can function like a human, but that's in a very narrow, specific task, or it's also referred to as artificial narrow intelligence. It's common now. I think because we are so trained to fear AI that as soon as we have a specific type of narrow AI, we no longer think of it as AI. We move the goalposts, so to speak. If we think about it, Watson beat the human champions in Jeopardy in 2011, and AlphaGo beat the predictive time when a program would beat a human at Go in 2016. And we use forms of artificial intelligence on a regular basis in our programming for listening to music. When we think of how AI relates to cars, we probably think of self-driving cars, but we've been using artificial intelligence in maps for years. They adjust driving directions, responding almost immediately to traffic updates, and adjusting accordingly. These things are very complex tasks. Now, general artificial intelligence, or artificial general intelligence, can be described as human-level AI. It's much more broad, and it doesn't exist yet. It's not specific to a task. The third form of artificial intelligence that some people refer to is superintelligence. The Swedish philosopher Nick Bostrom predicts that once we have developed artificial general intelligence, that program or those programs would almost immediately be able to create the new form of superintelligence. Now, we don't really have an idea of when or even if this would occur, but that level of intelligence to us humans is really inconceivable. As I've heard it put, I have the smartest cat in the world, but my cat can't speak French. So in that comparison, we humans would be the cat.
This poses an interesting challenge to our educators. With AI-empowered software, students can find the answers to their questions in a second without necessarily engaging the second stage of their brain, or in other words, enacting any cognitive strain whatsoever. Is this a problem or an opportunity? Here's Stephen Wolfram, founder and CEO of Wolfram Research and creator of Wolfram Alpha, Mathematica, and Wolfram Language.
Please can you explain, what is Wolfram Alpha?
Wolfram Alpha is we call it a computational knowledge engine. And its goal is to be able to automate answering questions that can be answered on the basis of knowledge that has been accumulated in our civilization. Those questions might be math questions, they might be questions about socioeconomic data, they might be questions about medical computations, all sorts of things.
Why do some educators get so upset about it and, equivalent services? And why do you think students love it so much?
I thought when we first introduced Wolfram Alpha 8 years ago now, I thought we'd have all kinds of educators up in arms, and I really haven't seen that. What I've seen instead is lots of people saying, it's so cool that we can get students to engage with kind of more real-world computations and so on, because, you know, Wolfram Alpha knows about all sorts of things about, I don't know, astronomy or chemistry or economics or something, and they can kind of see how sort of quantitative and computational thinking relates to those kinds of areas in a way that was not accessible to them before, that only a sort of super expert could have seen. But I think it's been this question of what should the humans do versus what should you let technology do? I think the thing to realize is that sort of throughout human history, one of our big successes has been the development of more and more technology that allows us to automate more and more things that we as humans had to do for ourselves. And my attitude is the thing that is important is for people to be able to operate in the world and be able to figure things out that are important to them. And that's something where they should use the best tools they can get to do that. And going forward into the future, we will have more and more technology to help us figure things out, and we should learn how to use that technology in the best possible way. There's a small minority of people who need to know how that technology works inside, but that's certainly not the typical student in school and so on.
So that's interesting, because there's a discussion around whether algorithms should be open and transparent, and I don't know if they are with Wolfram Alpha, but is your view that not really necessary for your average student, for example, learning mathematics?
Well, I mean, Wolfram Alpha, the actual operation of it internally, it's not what your average student would be interested in. What is relevant is to get intuition about how computational and, for example, mathematical things work. And a large part of the way you do that is by just seeing those things work. It's like developing physical intuition. You know, you have to actually see experiments, see how things work in the world. In mathematics, for example, we can use computers to do that, and it's really powerful. You know, going forward and looking at kind of the future of what people should be learning, I think kind of computational thinking is kind of at the core of what a lot of students, really all students, should be learning. I mean, it is basically the emerging paradigm for how things will work in the world.
And does Wolfram language, it means that you don't have to learn coding as a way of communicating your intentions with computational thinking, so it allows that to be a bit more natural to someone, perhaps?
Yes, that's the idea. I mean, the point of Wolfram language is to build as much knowledge about the world and about computation as possible into the language itself. So it allows you immediately to talk about, I don't know, the set of words in English, or the masses of planets, or do some computation about, what's the shortest path that visits lots of different cities in Europe or something. And those are things that you can immediately represent and do in the language. And, you know, if you look at a piece of Wolfram language code, so to speak, it's just written out in terms of words in English, and it's very obvious roughly what it's doing. It takes a little bit of learning to understand precisely what it's doing, but learning about precisely what it's doing, that's a critical kind of thing for people to understand, is how to think precisely and how to kind of formulate their thoughts in a way that's organized enough to be computed with, so to speak. And that means that we have a tremendous opportunity, even I think perhaps responsibility, to kind of teach the next generation how to think computationally using the tools that we've built. And it's kind of a consequence, an unexpected consequence of what we've done in terms of automating kind of the whole stack of computational capabilities.
So, with applications like PhotoMath or Wolfram Alpha, we can know the answers to math equations in an instant. The same is happening across education in other subjects such as language learning and sciences, and it would seem likely that this technology will continue to develop and become more sophisticated. But should human-level AI be achieved, what are the implications for our status as human learners and educators? Murray Shanahan is Professor of Cognitive Robotics in the Department of Computing at Imperial College London. In his book, The Technological Singularity, he gives the scenario of two teams tasked with creating a new high-performance motorbike for a global brand name. One is a human team of top-notch graduates, and the other is a specialist team of human-level AIs. Here's Murray reading from his book.
The AI-based design company seems to be at a distinct disadvantage. They have no automated design experts on their payroll. However, they have enormous computing resources and the latest AI technology on their side. They start by populating a virtual world with a set of off-the-shelf apprentice AIs. These are human-level artificial intelligences that come pre-loaded with the acquired experience of an average human in their early 20s, plus a graduate-level education in some relevant field, such as mechanical engineering or industrial design. Now, this group of apprentices isn't going to cut it as an automated design team. Their human rivals, in the other company, have all had years of industrial experience designing cars, bikes, and engines. To get up to speed, the AI team will have to acquire comparable experience. Of course, if this training had to take place in real time, the virtual team would get nowhere. But suppose the AIs operate 10 times faster than real time. By the start of year two of the project, the AI team will have caught up with the human team. Moreover, they will have 10 years of subjective time ahead of them to come up with the perfect superbike.
What's the moral of this story? Shanahan is quick to point out that many obstacles still prevent us from achieving human-level artificial intelligence described in the story today. Namely, issues around processing power and/or our still limited knowledge of how the brain works. But bringing things back to today's artificial intelligence and us as learners, isn't it right that we are inquisitive about the algorithms and technologies used to assist as learners? Are we in control or are they? What about inbuilt bias in the algorithms nudging us as learners into our optimal learning environments? Here's Peter Foltz, Vice President for Research at Pearson. He's the one who's working out globally how we assess 21st century higher thinking skills and combine machine learning with human instruction. As such, he's pretty popular these days.
Thank you very much.
So first off, what is adaptive learning?
Adaptive learning is really using computers as a way to understand the needs and abilities of students and modify the instruction that then address those particular needs for the student at the level of ability to allow them to succeed. So in order to do that, you need to be able to assess both the student's abilities, their capabilities, their prior performance, maybe even what they're interested in, and then you want to try to adjust the training so that it's best for them. And in its very rudimentary form, this can just be adapting based on performance in multiple choice. But in much better forms, what you can be looking at is all the information about a student's prior performance, everything the student is doing at a particular point, and trying to bring that together to be able to deliver the right learning experience to the right student at the right time.
You've been in this space for, you know, over a decade in terms of developing your previous company and then working within Pearson. How do you think the adaptive learning technology has developed during that time? And what was it in its most rudimentary form that you described? And then, you know, how has it developed and become more sophisticated?
Yeah, we're really working on trying to make the technology more sophisticated. In its most rudimentary form, I mean, adaptive learning is often thought about in areas like maths, where what you're doing is just looking at which problems a student gets right or wrong, and then just saying, well, if they get this one wrong, we need to train them a little bit more on any particular type of issue that they seem not to understand. But as we're really developing better technology, particularly better technology to assess higher level thinking skills in students, and also better technology to train some of these skills, what we can do is try to understand some of these 21st century skills and then be able to give better feedback to the students at the right times for it. So, for example, looking at performance of students when they're doing writing or communicating or collaborating. And what we're doing is developing new techniques that can assess students as they're doing that and then understand what things they're able to do and not. And based on that, we can adapt what kind of instruction they get or what kind of learning experiences they receive.
I think lots of the educators listening in are thinking about how, you know, how do you go about assessing some of these, what may be described as soft skills? Because I've asked this before to other people and they've mentioned simulation being used and things like that to actually eke out how to assess that. But it'd be really interesting to know how you go about it.
Sure, I'd be happy to talk about that, particularly in the form of collaboration. One of the issues with assessing collaboration is always you put a group of students together and they're always dependent on other students in doing the tasks. And it makes it very hard because one student in your group may be slacking off, another one may be trying to do all the work. So it's very hard to monitor the performance of any individual student. So within the PISA assessment, one of the things that we, along with a number of other groups, had developed is techniques that have students interacting with a variety of agents. And so we can create these kinds of situations where students are put in collaborative situations and must work in a chat environment, but we're mimicking the other students, but it allows us to assess students in all different kinds of situations. So we get to control the environment much better, but we also can ensure that students get good learning experiences.
So what are the implications for using adaptive learning, and how do we avoid algorithm bias?
Yeah, I think there are some reasonable concerns around about the potential of algorithm bias, and also that you can't see into the algorithms in order to know exactly what's going on. For a lot of what we do is we train our algorithms to learn how to score and give feedback much in the same way as a teacher does. And so, for instance, in one of the sides of work we do is we train our algorithms to be able to mark essays, and we have the computer learn to mark essays by reading a very large number of essays that have been marked by instructors and to learn what features are there. But when you do that, it's a little bit harder to look in and say, well, which features was the computer using in order to mark it? And so we always want to ensure that when we're doing that, that we're not creating an algorithm that is biased. What we find often is the algorithm can sometimes learn the biases of the human markers. And what we try to do then is, rather than train it on any particular marker, we train it on multiple instructors so it learns to average out across multiple people. We also then do a variety of things to ensure that if the algorithm sees something that looks really unusual, or if the algorithm does anything unusual, that there's always a human in the loop so that it can flag that essay, send it off to a human and say, hey, you better take a look at this one. So I think one of the key things and key way to avoid algorithm bias is to always ensure that there's at least some level of human in the loop for any kind of use of this. So it's not that everything's being turned over to the computer, but that there's a variety of ways that humans are overseeing the performance or also being alerted when there's odd performance going on.
So how can we use these technologies in combination with human instructors? So how do you sort of envision how these two things will sit alongside one another?
I think there's a lot of great ways to be able to integrate the technologies into the classroom and use them with instruction and with the teachers. And one of the ways we do this, particularly in writing instruction, is to use automated scoring of writing, where a student will receive an assignment that is assigned by the teacher. Student goes online, writes an essay, clicks submit. The computer marks that essay instantly within 1 second, gives the student feedback on a number of different things like the quality of their ideas, how well organized their essay is, their writing fluency, their mechanics, and it can give a variety of different other kinds of comments as well. The student then has that feedback immediately, can revise and resubmit the essay and do that multiple times in the space of an hour or so. Meanwhile, all that data is being fed to the instructor, who can then be monitoring a large class of students who are all writing and being able to see which students are performing well, which students are having difficulty, and the teacher can then focus on which students are having the problems. The nice thing about it that is that the instructor can still mark the last essay. So once a student has iterated multiple times with the computer, the student can still submit that essay to the instructor for final grading. But what we're doing is using the abilities of the computer to be able to mark instantly and give feedback very quickly. And allowing the ability of the instructor to be able to focus on finding the students who need the most help and help with the instruction. So it's a good way of being able to combine the best abilities of the computer, which can be very fast and very objective, with the abilities of the instructor who is able to go in and be able to give much better directed feedback to the students and find the students that need the help the most.
How do you see the kind of creation process in terms of new products that use AI in education? Is there room for educators to be involved in that, or is it more a kind of pure data analytics process?
Yeah, our goal really is not just to build tools for instructors, but to build tools with instructors. And based on my experience is that I can't just walk into a classroom and say, hey, here's a new piece of software, run with it. What we do is we go in and we observe classrooms, we talk to teachers, we talk to students, we find bottlenecks, we think about what the process is of how things are working in education, where things are not, where students are struggling, or where the instructors don't have the time to be able to do the right kinds of feedback. And then we work with them really to co-create the kinds of tools that we want to do. And what we're trying to do is come up with tools that will help the instructors use them to create better learning experiences for their students.
In the end, the most often talked about scenario for artificial intelligence, teachers and learners, is a shared intelligence reality where students, teachers and cognitive assistants work side by side. In the 2016 Pearson co-authored report, Intelligence Unleashed, An Argument for AI in Education, Rose Luckin and Wayne Holmes from UCL Knowledge Lab, and Mark Griffiths and Laurie Forcier from Pearson, put forward a vision of AI in education which could close achievement gaps and offer higher and wider levels of skills development than any education system has managed to date. The report recognises three critical forces that must be managed as the future of AI in education emerges, so listen in. Number one, involving teachers, students and parents in co-designing new tools so that AI in education addresses real needs of the classroom and other learner environments. Two, embedding proven pedagogical techniques in the design of new AI in education-powered edtech products. And number three, creating smart demand for commercial-grade AI in education products that work. So, the AI in education future is collaborative and demands pedagogical and evidence-based foundations. AI in education is not operating in a vacuum. Even way out into the future, if we go back to the case of the motorbike teams, human intelligence AI may have designed the bikes, but would they have had the dexterity to build them? Here's Dennis Hurley, Director of Future Tech at Pearson, to sum up on what is AI and what has it got to do with me and my students.
As with all exponential technologies, we should remember that these are tools to be used. They aren't something to be feared, and they aren't good or bad. It's about how we use them. And we can use them along with our best human skills. So, again, with these programs that are artificial narrow intelligence, we use them in conjunction with our best human traits. You can use the tools of artificial intelligence along with our human creativity, problem solving, and those skills, those human level skills that are going to be increasingly important in the future. So that is essential for our students, and it's essential for teachers to use these programs.
If you're an educator or student listening in, what are the questions you should be asking when you're thinking about using artificial intelligence tools in the way that you've just described?
When considering artificially intelligent tools to use in the classroom as a learner or as an educator, you can look for something that helps you move along in your learning process or in your teaching process. So it doesn't replace anything that you're doing, but it supplements it. It helps solve some gaps. You can also use some of these tools to complete tasks that are not essential to your actual learning process, but more rote procedures.
That's the end of our second episode in this series. Next week, we think about the future of work and how to develop calm digital citizenship outside of screaming dystopian headlines. Want to leave feedback? Tweet us at podcastedtech and at Dennis Hurley, DennisHurley, or check out the Pearson podcast page at tinyurl.com/PearsonFutureTech, where you can also find more content, reports and insight on everything from parental engagement, open APIs for edtech developers, or what skills you might need for the most prevalent jobs in 2030. I'll drop that link, show notes and more at www.theedtechpodcast.com. Thanks for listening in, and we look forward to hearing your own Future Tech for Education related stories.